Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Coming up, how is the obesity epidemic in America affecting relationships?
But first, with just a day to go until the Scottish referendum on independence, two separate polls indicate it's going to be a frantic 24 hours. Both show the no campaign at 52%, yes at 48%. With a margin of error, that's a tie. NPR's Ari Shapiro is in Edinburgh. And Ari, what is it like on the ground there?
It's been very exciting. We were just walking to dinner last night and ran into yes voters who were chalking in front of a bagpipe player in the middle of the Royal Mile, which is the center of Edinburgh, kind of a quintessentially Scottish scene. But wherever you go, there are bumper stickers that say no thanks. There are signs in the windows that say yes, Scotland. People feel that this is the kind of vote that comes along not once in many years, but once in generations. And whichever side people are on, there is a palpable sense of excitement to be a part of it.
Well, it sounds as if it's fevered, but I have to ask, chalking?
Chalking, writing slogans in chalk on the sidewalk, a popular tradition at college campuses that has extended to Scotland for the independence referendum.
Well, we understand that the Prime Minister of Britain, David Cameron, other members of Parliament visited to make some last-minute pleas. We know they are completely united in wanting a no vote. They offered more to Scotland if it stayed. What was offered and how was that received?
The specifics are vague. These offers came after the first poll ever showed independence leading ahead of unity. That was a poll that showed 51% for independence, 49% for unity. And it really scared the political leaders in London into realizing that independence could be reality. So they came back and said, a no vote will not be a vote for the status quo. It will be a vote for change. And we're going to offer Scotland more autonomy and more power to be specified after the referendum. And you have the independence camp coming back and saying, this is a bribe, and if London were serious about it, they would have offered it earlier. But it shows just how tight this has become and how afraid Westminster, the political parties in London, really are that this might not go their way tomorrow.
Well, remind us, for those just tuning in and realizing there's a day to go and we're at the finish line of this, the thumbnail of the stands of both sides. What is each claiming?
Well, from the Yes campaign's perspective, the interests of Scotland are not adequately represented by London. London is a conservative government. Scotland tends to be more left-leaning. Scotland says that the oil and gas money they would get from being an independent nation could keep them afloat economically. They believe they could prosper as an independent country. The No campaign argues that being a small country, going it alone in a big, bad world is not the way to go. And whether you look at the presence of British embassies around the world or the use of the pound or membership in the European Union or NATO or military alliances, all of these things would leave Scotland worse off if Scotland dissolved this 300-year-old United Kingdom that they've been a part of.
Well, and if you just look at next-door neighbors, I mean, we're reading about people who live right next door to each other or even in the same family divided on this issue. How concerned are people that no matter what way the vote goes, it's going to wound?
There are two ways to look at that. One way is, yes, people feel passionately and divided, and it's going to be a close vote, and people are going to wake up after the vote and find that half the country lost and half the country won. But the other way to look at it is to compare it to independence movements around the world that have been so contentious, they have been violent, and there have been refugees, and there have been people killed. And viewed from that angle, what's happening in Scotland is really kind of an exemplary model of democracy at work. The fact is, whatever happens after this vote, it won't be the same. A yes vote will start years of intense, difficult negotiations on how to separate these two countries that have been bound together for so long. And a no vote will bring a new relationship between Scotland and England that also has yet to be determined. And so whatever happens, this vote is the beginning, not the end of the story.
Well, and there hasn't been much international backing for independence. And yet here we have this Alex Salmond. He is the man behind the yes vote. He is described as someone born into the working classes who moved this issue from the fringes. You know, people thought it was just crazy, to the cusp of history, as it's being written today. He might play a big role in an independent Scotland.
you're right that the global community has not been very supportive of this independence movement, partly because big business doesn't like change. The world likes to depend on borders being more or less where they've been, and that Alex Salmond really has ridden this wave, this tidal wave. He's the head of the SNP, the Scottish National Party, which for many decades was viewed as a fringe party, which sort of took everybody by surprise, winning the Scottish elections in 2011. A referendum on independence had been part of their platform basically forever. And so when they won in 2011, they said, all right, well, I guess we better put this independence referendum on the ballot. And nobody expected it to pass. In the history of Scotland, there had never been a poll showing independence in the lead, except now here we are. The polls are virtually tied and nobody's sure what'll happen.
NPR's Ari Shapiro in Edinburgh, ahead of tomorrow's referendum on independence. Ari, lucky you to be there. We'll talk to you then. Thank you.
Thanks. Talk soon, Robin.
Well, here in this country, a study out today finds 54% of American adults have abdominal obesity. That's the most dangerous kind. It's up from 46% about 15 years ago. It's in today's Journal of the American Medical Association. Abdominal obesity, by the way, means a waistline of more than 35 inches in women and more than 40 in men. It is a concern from a health perspective, but according to a new book, it's also complicating America's love life. Sarah Varney is the author of XL Love. She's with us from KQED in San Francisco. Sarah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to start where you do at the beginning of the book, which is with young girls and boys, but specifically young girls here. And you find that the more obese they are, the more likely they are to be sexually active at a young age.
Well, we know that obesity plays an important role, or I should say that excess weight plays an important role in the development of puberty. So one of the things I was really interested in was going to a place like Mississippi, where they've had obesity, widespread levels of obesity, particularly among girls and boys for many, many years. And I spent some time in the Mississippi Delta talking to one of the local physicians there. And, you know, he has these girls who are 5 and 6 years old who have developed pubic hair. So the puberty process, the pubertal process is already starting for them. So he's having to give them hormone shots to try and ward off the further development of puberty. And when you talk to the pediatric endocrinologist in Jackson, they're incredibly busy, and they're seeing some of the most, if you could say, interesting cases really in the country. They have these girls who are, you know, 5, 6, 7 years old who are starting puberty. But what we're really seeing is this actually happening around the country. So what we now know is that the percentage of girls that are beginning to develop breasts by the age of 7, about 23% of African American girls, about 15% of Latinos, and about 10% of whites. So this is a pretty significant change from just several decades ago. And we also know that for boys, puberty is also starting earlier for boys. But one of the big concerns that I heard in places like Mississippi is that many of these boys are not just developing fat, but developing breast tissue. And we know that women who are obese have far higher, are much higher risk for breast cancer. And what we don't know is what happens to boys who develop breast tissue in terms of their increased risk for breast cancer later in life. So all of this sort of sets particularly girls up to become, in a sense, much more sexualized at a much earlier age.
And engage in more risky sexual behavior.
So this is what's interesting is when you look at obese girls in particular, on average, they are less likely to be sexually active. But those obese girls who are sexually active are much riskier. So they're much more likely to have had sex by the age of 13. They're much more likely to have had multiple sex partners by the end of high school. And they're much less likely to use contraception. So these are a lot of the concerns, of course, among pediatricians and pediatric endocrinologists that are working with this population.
And yet, adolescents who are overweight are half as likely to begin dating as healthy weight teens.
Yeah, so this is what's really interesting is not only is obesity, from what I was able to find, disrupting, you know, how and when the stages of life are marked, puberty, for instance, but it also seems to be really changing the romantic prospects for obese and overweight girls and boys. One of the first studies that really looked at this was in 2005. And essentially what it found was that for every 1 point increase in weight for teens, for girls, their chances of a romantic relationship decreased by 6 to 7%. So there's this relationship between weight and romantic success.
And you point out that this is a problem that is really growing in the United States. During the past 20 years, you write, the average weight of those in the dating pool has changed dramatically. A map of obesity rates in 1985 shows only 8 states shaded dark blue, where 10% to 14% of adults are obese. Then they have to add a different color to make it 20% because more states are getting there, then 25%. And by 2012, you write, 2 out of 3 American adults would be overweight or obese.
Absolutely. I mean, this is what's really interesting is when, and the CDC, in fact, you can go onto their website and watch this map as it changes over that time period that I describe. And it's really extraordinary to think that the average human body has changed in America, has changed so dramatically in just such a short period of time. You know, and the way I think about it is, what if everybody in America all of a sudden grew, you know, a foot taller, you know, over the course of 20 years, we would all be wondering, you know, what is going on here? In the case of being taller, you know, there might not be as significant implications, health implications, of course, as there are with obesity. But nonetheless, it's really important, I think, to kind of step back and take note of just how swift this epidemic of obesity has been.
And we'll put a link to that map, by the way, at our website, hereandnow.org. But it's not just that it's been swift. It's that when you look at kids now and the trends going forward, you write that there's going to be a much higher percentage of adults with diabetes, for example.
Yes, what we know is that when you are overweight or particularly obese as a child, you're almost guaranteed to be obese for the rest of your life. Around 80 to 90% of boys and girls, it's a little different for boys and a little different for girls, will become obese adults. And they will fight weight for the rest of their life or be obese for the rest of their life. One of the things that's interesting is, you know, we've started to see a few studies here and there that seem to be showing a leveling off of obesity rates among, particularly among toddlers and young children, sort of age 2 to 5. I'll say, though, that, I mean, that research is still very young, very early, and there's been some interesting studies that have come out since then to say we may have reinterpreted these data. So I don't think there's any reason to celebrate just yet. But also what we're finding is that the percentage of children who are very obese, you know, morbidly obese at very young ages has continued to increase. So that sort of upper boundary of very large children, of very heavy children, has continued to grow significantly.
And Sarah Varney, we were talking about how this is impacting kids. Let's talk about adults. And let's say there's a relationship where one adult is overweight and one is not. What happens in a relationship like that?
So social scientists for many years were trying to figure out what kinds of relationships vis-a-vis body type, body weight, are the happiest. And their research was really all over the map for a long time. At first, there were some studies that showed overweight and obese women, but particularly obese women, were the happiest in their relationship. And the thinking from economists and social scientists and others was that perhaps, you know, these were women and in some cases men who were very relieved to be in a relationship. Then you saw other studies that showed, no, it was the partners of obese women or men that were very unhappy, or it was only people who were slender and normal, quote, normal weight were happy. So it was all over the map for a long time. And then there was this interesting study where they basically looked at the comparative weight between the husband and the wife. And these are heterosexual couples that they look at. And essentially what they found was that it did not matter if the couple necessarily was, quote, normal weight. It just simply mattered if the husband weighed more than the wife or was heavier, in a sense, than the wife. So, you know, you could be an overweight woman and be in a satisfying relationship so long as your husband was just simply bigger than you were.
Hmm. But there is also a real issue of your own body image, because even if your husband, let's say you're an overweight woman, even if your husband finds you attractive, you might not see it that way. And so no matter what he's saying to you about how beautiful you are, you're never going to believe it.
No, that's exactly right. And one of the main characters in the book is this wonderful woman, Dana, and her husband, Larry. And they really let me into their lives in a way that was incredibly generous. And we meet Dana when she's at her top weight. She was a heavy woman when she and Larry married. Larry was not heavy. And she just talks about how, you know, the last sort of 65 pounds that she had put on really fundamentally changed her attitude. That she'd always been unhappy with her weight, but now she describes saying, you know, feeling like now I'm a, quote, I'm a monster. You know, I'm this unlikable fat girl. And so even though Larry is very loving and very, you know, wants to be intimate with her, she just shuts down. And this is very common when you talk to psychologists and therapists. I talked to many of them all over the country, and they said this is very, very common. So we meet Dana at this kind of crisis moment in her life where really her relationship with her husband has really been put on ice. And so they're now living, you know, as roommates, essentially. Hmm. And she's just terribly, terribly unhappy. Then we kind of go back in her life and we go back to her childhood to sort of try and find out how did she end up with this really poor body image in the first place. She was not a very big child, but, you know, by the time she was 18, 19, 20 years old and she had finished college and she married her first husband and had a child, she gained a lot of weight and just struggled with it for the next several decades. But then, interestingly enough, we meet her when she's had after she's had bariatric surgery and she's lost about 100 pounds. And she's sort of hoping that, you know, this is going to be the panacea that's going to solve all of her relationship problems. This is very common among people who have bariatric surgery, that there's this hope that everything that's wrong with my life must be related to my weight. And so if I fix this one thing, then all these other things will fall into place. And what we find is that it's much more complicated than that, of course. And Larry had really had stopped thinking about his wife in that way. You know, he talks about, I had stopped really reading her signs. And
because he got rejected so often.
So often, exactly. So, you know, there's a lot of work that, I mean, every couple has to do, of course. But when you throw weight into it and you throw the level of sort of self-hatred and body image issues in, it becomes a lot to deal with. But also all of the physical problems that for Dana, for instance, that came with her weight. Her knees constantly hurt her. She had terrible sleep apnea. You know, she was worried she was going to have a heart attack. So there's some very real physical problems that people who are overweight and obese deal with that very much confound their relationships, not only with themselves, but with their spouse.
There's also this tension for the spouse between trying to get your partner to lose weight or trying to make them feel comfortable in their own skin and not feel that they have to lose weight. But in some cases, it's a health issue for them. And by not telling them that they need to lose weight, you're doing them a disservice.
Yeah, and we hear from several people in the book who comment about that. You know, one woman in Southern California who she and her husband had been very big together and had a lot of, you know, what she would say is just terrible eating habits. And there was one point where she had stopped off and gotten McDonald's for the kids, and she's home and she's sort of surveying her house and she's seeing how she's kind of raising this next generation of children to be just like her and her husband. And she just kind of has this moment where she says, you know, no more. So she decides that she's going to lose some weight. And what's very difficult is her husband doesn't make the same decision. And it ultimately ends up ending their marriage because she really feels like he's putting his needs and his need to eat this way and not exercise before me and before the kids. So you hear that a lot from the therapists that work with folks either in bariatric surgery support groups or weight loss groups, that, you know, a good marriage can survive significant weight loss, but a bad marriage has a very difficult time surviving it because it just upsets the dynamics too much in the relationship.
Of course, many times people get married and they're not obese, and then one person gains weight over time. Is there any sense of whether that changes the love life and the dynamic in the relationship?
There's been quite a bit of research done looking at the types of fights that they're called mixed weight marriages. And mixed weight marriages tend to have much more friction. And it's not just the sort of, you know, you get into your typical marital argument. It's pretty vicious stuff. So, you know, in these cases, we've got married couples who are mixed weight who are writing down diaries for weeks and weeks at a time, kind of narrating their relationship. You know, when did they fight? What was it about? What were the kinds of comments? And then researchers will go through and sort of grade it. And what they find is that the types of arguments are much more personal, they're much more vicious, and there's a lot more fighting and friction in those marriages.
Sarah Varney, one thing I wanted to ask you about that I noticed in this book and hadn't heard about before is that a number of people who are overweight have mirrors that are so small that they can only see their face because they don't want to see the rest of their body.
Yeah, this is very common. You know, I spent several years reporting and researching this book and talking to as many people as I possibly could, going to a lot of group meetings and other things. And this is a very common thing that you hear. Dana describes it really beautifully, and it's very sad that when she walks through her house, she would take these mirrors and just really have them at her nose and up so that she could do her eye makeup, but she just didn't want to see herself. And you hear that a lot from people who are overweight and obese, that, you know, I don't allow pictures of myself taken. there aren't pictures of me up in my home. And oftentimes, you know, one of the characters in the book, Eric, describes how he and his wife had, they didn't have any idea that they had gotten so as big as they had gotten because they hadn't seen a picture of themselves in forever. And then somebody took a photo of them and sent it to them in the mail. And they describe, you know, opening it up and looking at it and saying, wow, this is me. So there is a lot of this separation, you know, separating myself from my own body, not wanting to really know what it looks like.
Sarah Varney is the author of XL Love, How the Obesity Crisis is Complicating America's Love Life. Fascinating new book. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy. I really appreciate it.
The Pocono Mountains School District and the Wallenpoepack School District are both closed in northeast Pennsylvania as a massive hunt continues for 31-year-old Eric Freen, suspected of shooting two police officers, killing one in the Pocono Mountains Friday night, and now being heavily armed and dangerous. Pennsylvania police say Freen is a survivalist. They say his father, a veteran of 28 years in the Army, says his son is an excellent marksman who doesn't miss. Michael Rubenkamp is with the Associated Press, and he is there in northeast Pennsylvania. And Michael, the police are further saying the father's also said he's missing two weapons, an AK-47 and a rifle with a scope. How are people feeling in that area?
Well, people obviously are jittery. They're on edge. Here's a guy who police are saying is armed, heavily armed with high-powered rifles and very dangerous. And he's on the loose.
Yeah. Tell us how this all began. Remind us, Friday night, this was at another police barracks in the Poconos?
Yes, it was at the Blooming Grove Barracks, a very rural barracks in the Pocono Mountains. One trooper was leaving the barracks after his shift. Another trooper was arriving at the barracks to begin work when the gunfire started. One trooper was hit and killed. Another trooper seriously wounded.
How did they find Eric Freen? How did police, what trail led to Eric Freen?
Police got their big break on Monday. A guy out walking his dog came across a Jeep Cherokee about 2 miles from the shooting scene. It was submerged in a pond. Police arrived, processed that Jeep, and they found a shell casing, multiple shell casings that matched those found at the shooting scene. They found Freen's driver's license, his Social Security card, and Pennsylvania Game Commission range permit. They also found camouflage face paint and two empty rifle cases. Yeah.
This sounds like one of those cases, at least according to Associated Press reporting, where people who knew him do not seem that surprised that he might be a suspect.
That's absolutely right. State police say that Freen has held anti-law enforcement views for many years. They say he expressed them both online and to people who knew him, and that this did not come as a surprise at all to people who knew him.
Yeah. People outside the area might not know the Poconos is a bucolic vacation area, as well as, of course, people living there, going to school there. We mentioned two whole districts closed. What's the thinking going ahead? How much longer will that happen?
Not exactly sure. Obviously, school officials today felt that it was prudent to shut down while state police conducted this massive manhunt. They're searching over miles of heavy forest, and the school officials felt that it was just the prudent thing to do. Now, if this thing drags on for day after day, they're going to have a decision to make. Do we send the kids to school, or do we continue to call off? And I don't know that decision's been made yet.
Yeah. Meanwhile, as we mentioned, one policeman was killed. Do we know how the other is doing?
The other, Corporal Brian Dixon, as you mentioned, was killed. His viewing will be today and his funeral tomorrow. The wounded trooper, Alex Douglas, he was shot in the pelvis. He was critically wounded, underwent surgery. But he apparently is recovering, and police were hoping to talk to him, obviously, to get his information.
That's Michael Rubenkamp with the AP. Again, the Pocono Mountain School District, the Wallenpoepack School Districts, both in the Poconos there in Pennsylvania, closed. That's the area where they're searching for 31-year-old Eric Freen, a suspect in the shooting of and the killing of one police officer, the shooting of two. Michael, thanks for updating us.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now, and negotiations over Iran's nuclear program resume this Friday in New York between Iran and six world powers. The latest talks are aimed at giving Iran relief from sanctions if Iran accepts strict limits intended to keep it from acquiring a nuclear weapon. The last negotiations ended in July with only an agreement to keep trying for a few more months. NPR's Steve Inskeep sat down with Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, who's in New York for those negotiations and for the UN General Assembly. Zarif said that Iran was ready for a deal, but that the U.S. has been less than honest in negotiations. He said there was too much opposition to a deal among Americans.
So if they think any deal with Iran is a bad idea, there's no amount of I don't want to call it concession, no amount of assurance that is inherent in any deal that could satisfy them, because they're not interested in a deal, period, and they'll try to use excuses to kill a deal.
Zarif also addressed the situation in Iraq and the possibility that Iran and the U.S. could work together in their fight against their common enemy, ISIS.
Could there be a situation where in some military headquarters in Iraq there's an American advisor standing there and an Iranian advisor standing 5 feet away?
I don't think so, because I do not believe that the type of activity that the United States is interested in engaging in is similar to helping Iraqis defend their territory.
What is the difference between Iran's approach and the U.S.?
We work with the people. We work with the government. We don't tell them what to do. We don't instruct them what to do. We help. We help in whatever way we can. And that makes us quite different from the United States. The United States is a major military power. That has created an illusion in the United States that it can coerce, that it can order people around, that it can instruct people on how to deal with their problems. That's not how we see ourselves.
Steve Inskeep talking with the Iranian foreign minister. You can hear the rest of that conversation tomorrow on Morning Edition. Well, there are just 47 days left until the midterm election, so let's get to this week's district profile. Each week on Here and Now, we're looking at the race in a single congressional district, and this week it is Iowa's third, where Democrats Stacey Apple and Republican David Young are in a close race to fill the seat being vacated by retiring Republican Congressman Tom Latham. Sarah Bowden of Iowa Public Radio joins us from Des Moines to tell us more. Sarah, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And we should say that you are currently in the third congressional district because it includes Des Moines. Tell us more about the district.
Yes, Des Moines is the biggest city in the third district. It starts in Des Moines, which is in the center of the state, and spans south and west to the Nebraska and the Missouri borders. Most of the third district is agricultural, though, because Des Moines is a hub for both finance and the insurance industry. There are a lot of people employed in those professions.
And let's get to the candidates. And first to the former state senator, the Democrat, Stacey Apple. Here's an ad that she's running.
I'm Stacey Apple. I'm running for Congress because the way I see it,
there needs to be a lot more Iowa common sense in Washington. And for me, that means getting things done ahead of politics and partisanship.
I served in the state Senate from 2007 to 2011. And led the effort to pass voluntary quality preschool and to pass equal pay for equal work.
What should we know about Stacey Apple?
Well, Stacey Apple is a mother of six, and she references this a lot in campaign speeches and in commercials. And she really says that this has prepared her to work in Congress because a lot of compromise. She says that being a mother of six, you're a real person with real life experience, and she will be able to bring that to Washington. She wants voters to see her as just like everyone else.
And we know that Hillary Clinton was just there in Iowa over the weekend for Tom Harkin's steak fry. Was Stacey Apple there at that event?
Yes, she was. And Apple said that it was a thrill to be on stage with Senator Harkin and the Clintons. She seemed to have had a very good time at the steak fry.
And maybe some good steak as well. Well, let's get to Republican David Young, who is a former chief of staff to the longtime GOP Senator Chuck Grassley. Here's a recent ad from David Young.
I'm David Young, and I approve this message. Barack Obama promised us hope. Then he ripped apart our health care system, shredded our economy, and crumbled our national security. But if we band together and fight for our conservative principles, we can put our economy and our country back together again.
and we hear him there ripping up a campaign ad for President Obama. Then he pulls out an American flag out of his pocket at the end. Tell us more about David Young.
David Young, like you said, is Senator Grassley's former chief of staff. Senator Grassley is incredibly popular, so Young is talking a lot about his time in Grassley's office, which, though voters are annoyed and upset with Washington gridlock, Young is really touting his experience with Grassley and says that he can hit the ground running on day one if elected to Congress.
Voters always love to hate Washington, but they love their own representative. And
they want their cake and can eat it too.
Well, and it sounds like Young is trying to tie his opponent, as many Republicans are around the country, to President Obama.
And that's going to be tough because Apple hasn't served in national office. Mm. So she has the advantage of deciding how much she wants to distance herself from the Obama administration.
What are some of the big issues for voters? What do people care about in this district?
Well, life in Iowa is pretty good. We have a very low unemployment rate. Cost of living's low. Gallup ranks Iowa as the 7th in the nation for job creation. However, financial issues, money issues are very important for the 3rd District, like the rest of the country, because the recession hit Iowa, and even though life is good in Iowa, these issues are so important.
Is there a lot of outside money coming into this race?
For both candidates, about 2/3 of the donation come from out of state. These are the usual suspects, according to Open Secrets. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, Freedom Works for America, the National Republican Congressional Committee. It doesn't seem that any of the money coming from out of state is terribly issue-based.
And Iowa is a state, by the way, that went to President Obama in 2012 and 2008, but it did go for George W. Bush in 2004 and just barely for Al Gore in 2000. So it has been really a toss-up state. What are polls saying about this election?
Iowa is definitely a swing state. There hasn't been a lot of polling in this race. The most recent poll, a Loras College poll, has Apple slightly ahead. However, the candidates are within single digits of each other, just outside the margin of error. So it could be anyone's race. And in 2012, even though the 3rd District went for President Obama, Republican Tom Latham won. So it's very much a swing congressional district as well.
Sarah Bowden of Iowa Public Radio talking with us about Iowa's 3rd congressional district. Sarah, thank you.
Thank you.
Fuel efficiency for new vehicles hit a record high 25.8 miles per gallon last month. That's up 24% from August 2008. But what if you could get 300 miles per gallon? From our tech partner IEEE Spectrum, Giselle Weiss takes us to Germany for a look at the technology that can make it happen, but it won't be for everyone.
The town of Wolfsburg is one of Germany's several motor cities. Specifically, it's the headquarters of Volkswagen, the largest carmaker in Europe, and the producer of vehicles such as the Golf, the Passat, and the fabulously successful Beetle. I'm here to check out VW's XL1. It's the company's first plug-in hybrid, and so efficient that it can get over 300 miles to a gallon of gas.
If you're coming to the car, it's a quite amazing design. And the design is one reason why we have such a low fuel consumption.
That's Volker Käse, head of the XL1 project. The secret to lowering fuel consumption, he says, is to decrease a car's wind resistance. For inspiration, the XL1's designers took a close look at sharks, masters of aerodynamic efficiency. The result is a car that's tailed, wider at the front than at the back.
Air is flowing under the car and you have it fully covered. Air resistance under the car is really low as well.
In addition to a lithium-ion battery for the plug-in powertrain, the car sports a 2-cylinder turbocharged direct injection diesel engine. The engine is at the rear.
And this TDI engine, if you look inside, is half the size of a normal Golf engine. So we cut 2 cylinders of this 4-cylinder engine. It's not as simple as it sounds.
Everything is designed to minimize drag. The gas tank holds just 2.6 gallons. The passenger seat is slightly offset from the driver's seat to save width. We settle ourselves into the XL1's bucket seats. Volker pushes the ignition button.
Start engine.
Okay.
and we start off in electric mode. The car can go about 32 miles on the battery alone.
That's it. It's the sound. And all what you hear is the wheels on the street. Now this is the brake, and you have this ceramic brakes.
We take off north, past the science park, past the historic smokestacks of the Volkswagen factory, past the sports stadium, past towers loaded with cars for delivery to customers.
Now we are driving 70 kilometers per hour, and all what you hear is the bearings and the wheels working, normal sound. Now I'm accelerating, you hear it? It's more sportive, and I get electric energy and the combustion energy for accelerating now.
We speed up some more, and the fuel consumption registers 1.2 liters per 100 kilometers on a screen on the dashboard. That's not quite 300 miles per gallon, but it's still a lot. The European Union has mandated sharp reductions in fuel emissions for new cars by 2020. That's why high-efficiency technologies like the XL1 matter. But hold your horses. At €111,000, about $150,000, the XL1 carries a hefty price tag. Moreover, Volkswagen only intends to market 200 of the vehicles, and it won't be sold in America. The first car was delivered to a customer in Germany at the end of May. The idea behind the XL1 was very specific: to combine low fuel consumption and great design in a single vehicle, and to show that it could sell. To make a super efficient car that is also really cool. For the people. Some of the people. For Here and Now, I'm Giselle Weiss in Wolfsburg, Germany.
And Giselle's story comes to us from our tech partner IEEE Spectrum. We all know the old adage, practice makes perfect, or as Florida State University psychology professor K. Anders Ericsson claimed in 1993, it takes 10,000 hours. Golf guru Dave Peltz made it 10,000 putts. Tennis instructors talk about 10,000 strokes. Author Malcolm Gladwell made it all accepted wisdom in his 2008 book, Outliers. So it's gospel, right? 10,000 times something shifts, you're a master. Well, maybe not, according to some new research. Brooke McNamara is assistant professor of psychology at Case Western Reserve University and co-author of a paper that says the 10,000-hour thing may not help. Professor, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So 10,000 strokes, 10,000 hours, that's become the shorthand for what we're talking about. But what did you research?
So what we did is we conducted a meta-analysis. This means we searched across the literature and included all studies that had investigated this topic and looked for patterns across all of them. So what we found was accumulated lifetime high-quality practice, deliberate practice, on average accounted for about 12% of performance variance. The 12% doesn't refer to how much better an individual will get. Obviously, we know from practice we get better. What it means is it accounts for about 12% on average when you're trying to compare individuals. So if I have two individuals and one is better than the other at a certain task, the amount of practice that they each have only accounts for about 12% of those differences across people.
And what else accounts for it?
Well, that's the great question. There's likely many factors that come into play. So experience other than deliberate practice, such as experience with competitions or in high-pressure situations or just experience on the job, likely plays a role. Your self-confidence in yourself to perform well in a given situation, how much confidence other people have in you is likely to have an effect, as does general abilities that we know are highly heritable, such as intelligence or working memory.
And can you also inherit, I'm sure this is also being studied, they're talking about runners in Africa, that you can inherit an ability to do something.
Right. So lots of people are starting to look at twin studies. So you can compare identical twins and fraternal twins and get a sense of what's shared environment versus shared genes. And we're seeing that genes play a big role.
Well, so the research will go on to determine what exactly it is that makes someone a master at something, if in fact, you know, 10,000 hours of practice doesn't have that much of an edge. Let's stay with that for a second. That is extremely disturbing, you know, for people who are out there practicing or telling their kids to practice. In fact, What was the reaction of your colleagues when you came to this conclusion?
So we had someone who actually said, think of the children. How can you tell them not to study? So, right, we're not saying that at all. Studying is important. Practice is important. It just doesn't account for everything. There are other differences across people. So we're not all the same, and not all tasks are the same. So, for example, games such as chess, accumulated practice accounted for about 26%. Music was 21%, sports 18%, education 4%, and then other professions that didn't fall in one of those categories, less than 1%.
You're saying maybe doing it over and over again was only 1%.
We've gotten some different responses as well. Some people saying, oh, this is such a relief. Now I can say, okay, maybe I just wasn't made for golf or for some other sport.
That's Brooke McNamara. She's assistant professor of psychology at Case Western Reserve in Ohio. We're talking about the paper she co-authored that found that becoming an expert takes more than just those 10,000 hours of practice. Professor, thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, Jeremy, I don't know. I think I'm going to stick with the 10,000-hour thing because I have them, and they've got to be worth something. Please tell me. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.